Welcome to Article 4 of the 2019, Volume 1, Issue 1, Winter Podcast Edition of the Journal of Philosophy of Emotion, published March 28, 2025. All contents are protected under the Creative Commons, Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives, 4.0 International Deed. For citations, notes, and references, please refer to the printed articles at www.jpeonline.org.
Emotions, Reasons, and Norms by Evan Simpson.
The familiar dichotomy between reason and emotional responses to things is pretty clearly too sharp. After all, fear is a fitting response when one perceives a threat. The particular threat is a reason for the fear. Although it would not be irrational to feel nothing, the fearful response has a cognitive rationale absent from fear of something obviously harmless. Indeed, even fitting fears are subject to thoughtful criticism, as when one who accepts military norms suggests that fear the enemy is not worthy of a soldier. Since such norms are themselves open to criticism, however, judgments of emotional worthiness may generate disputes that have no clear resolution, leading to a tension between norm conformity and a philosophical understanding of rationality that has been identified by the anthropologist Michael Tomasello, among others. This discussion explicates and relaxes that tension. The problem is clear for moral emotions, such as sympathy and respect. They motivate us to care about others' well-being in ways that may seem to collide with the philosophical criterion of rationality. According to this criterion, rational people arguably find it difficult to respect their promises. For example, if I make you a promise, but the opportunity then arises to do better for you by breaking it, then surely I should do that in violation of the norms of promising. There are many ways of responding to such problems, but the one developed here starts from the semantic fact that most ethical concepts are both evaluative and descriptive. It is framed by the assumption that the evaluated component is a motive and proceeds in three stages. The result is to show how mastery of ethical language enables norms of virtuous behavior to provide good moral reasons even while defying strictly rational agreement. The first stage reviews Tomasello's findings about human norm conformity and a problem for such conformity, resulting from what he identifies as a dominant philosophical conception of rationality. The often neglected distinction between emotional fittingness and emotional worthiness will be important to formulating a broader conception of a well-reasoned argument. The next stage identifies a scope for reasonable norm conformity in the constant evaluated valences of ethical terms, as distinguished from more descriptive and institutional language. Developing these distinctions will help to show how the difference between semantic agreement and ethical agreement creates an area for emotional worthiness within the space of reasons. In the third stage, I argue that the semantics of the thick ethical concepts whose use is prominent in moral deliberation entails that linguistically competent human beings have good, but rarely conclusive reason to be bound by ethical as well as linguistic norms. Rationality versus norm conformity in Tomasello's findings. Tomasello's Natural Histories of Human Thinking, Tomasello 2014, and Morality, Tomasello 2016, both develop an account of mental attributes that human beings share with great apes and our immediate common ancestors. All members of the human species have had the ability to recognize both physical and agent of causality, that is, the physical effects of some things upon others and the way in which an animal's goals lead to its actions. Such agency is a self-regulated, cognitive way of doing things that is basically identical to the classic belief-desire model of rational action in philosophy, a goal or desire coupled with an epistemic connection to the world. Creates an intention to act in a particular way, Tomasello 2014-9. So far, this is only individual intentionality, since, if Tomasello is right, the great apes are self-interested and manipulative rather than moral agents. They are well aware of social structures, recognizing dominance and affiliation, but use this knowledge as data for generating their own advantage. In short, they display the philosophical conception of rational action, as described by Tomasello. Within Tomasello's evolutionary story, the selective pressures which led early humans to hunt big game together also led to the development of we dash or joint intentionality from individual intentionality. We dash or joint intentionality being a mode of social engagement consisting of agents deliberately working together on tasks that neither could accomplish alone. Eventually, The material successes of such collaborations resulted in conditions favoring the full collective intentionality that is marked by accepting social norms of cooperation. Expanding societies created the problem of dealing with strangers. It was solved by the creation of cultural conventions, such as institutions whose constituted rules are public knowledge, enabling everyone to conform to the expectations of anonymous others. Those rules form part of the socially established roles, such as owner, spouse, or president, along with their rights and responsibilities, that recognize and integrate individuals into their broader societies. Tomasello's story includes plausible accounts of the development of language from iconic gestures and pantomimes to propositionally structured speech. It also depicts the emergence of a commitment to informing others of things honestly and accurately. Tomasello, 2014, 51. But with the emergence of this commitment, the species no longer clearly reflects the model of rational action in philosophy. Tomasello, 2014, 51. On the one hand, there is a joint intentionality that enables people to assess one another's tendency to cooperate given each person's interest in realizing their own desires. On the other hand, we have the willingness to communicate clearly and honestly, even in cases when dissimulation would better realize an agent's desires. The imperatives of socialization then allow the motive of conformity to the rules to overcome the benefits of instrumental calculation. The philosophical challenge posed by Tomasello's psychological findings is that they make it doubtful whether human beings can be both fundamentally norm-conforming creatures and also rational agents. While instrumentally rational individuals must observe the general practice of telling the truth for the most part, that fact does not imply any further concern for honesty or any susceptibility to emotions of resentment, indignation, and guilt for violating agreements. These emotions may certainly be fitting and thus supported by reasons in this sense, but they are arguably unworthy emotions because they violate the philosophical criterion of rationality. The tension between norm conformity and rationality seems behaviorally unstable, but Tomasello perceives a necessary connection between recognizing social rules and accepting their validity. That is, he notes how we place the rules within a communal framework that provides public standards against which one's behavior is evaluated. Recognizing these standards, individuals regard the values of their society as moral facts. Thus, in the course of our development, we modern humans will have experienced coordination problems whose solution on the behavioral level was a creation of group-wide, agent-neutral conventions, norms, and institutions to which everyone expected everyone in cultural common ground to conform. Tomasello, 2014, 113. However, this solution extends beyond behavioral conformity to accepting the norms as valid deontic constraints upon one's action. That may be broadly psychologically accurate, but it still leaves a philosophical issue about rationality open. Point four, no doubt most of us do usually act according to prevailing norms and even happily internalize them, but that is another thing from rationally accepting them. To engage in rational action, in Tomasello's philosophical sense, is to understand that we should hold ourselves apart from social norms, as when we recognize institutional facts but qualify our commitment to the institution in question in order to maximize our personal goals. In short, the objectivity of social norms and rationality of endorsing them remain competing notions within human thinking. Tomasello is fully aware of this tension and poses the gaping question of why we reify and objectify our social constructions, regarding them as real in a way that justifies using the language of true and right of them rather than focusing on them as the inherently contestable norms of different social groups. Tomasello, 2014, 153. In his Natural History of Human Morality, in particular, he consistently places the words objective and objectivity in scare quotes. Tomasello, 2014, 856. I propose a means of addressing these philosophical concerns by identifying the competent use of ethical language, the language of virtues and vices, moral worthiness and guilt, a quest for emotional worthiness that justifies rule following by displacing, without forsaking the strategic model of rational action Tomasello ends in philosophy. The key task is showing how the moral emotions manifest a complementary model of good, but still contestable reasons for conformity. We can begin by looking at the important moment in Tomasello's story of language that occurs with modern humans conventionalizing their natural gestures into collective linguistic practices and gaining in the process powerful new resources for thinking. This part of the story is consistent with an individualistic view of our pre. linguistic judgments as being enhanced through a common tongue that transforms primitive thinking and gives human beings intellectual capacities scarcely comparable to the rudimentary thoughts of other animals. The emergence of reason, along with the development of perspicuous words, evidently requires voluntary signs, whose meaning is fixed across different individuals by a kind of contract. Speakers of the same language cooperate in employing these signs to elicit matching conceptions, achieving the same understanding of the words by common consent. However, the development of clear words on this broadly Hobbesian view is not an outcome of reason agreement, because it is a condition of reasoning, implying that linguistic practices differ from the cooperative agreements that are typical of agents who practice joint intentionality. It is not a matter of deciding to comply with them or to take the consequences. As a result, established facts of the sort, red means red in English, persist because they cannot be seriously questioned by self-interested individuals. As Joseph Heath notes, we are not self-sufficient agents who might coherently choose to abandon the social rules governing the meaning of our spoken words. Hence, we can normally trust others to mean what they seem to mean by their sentences. While we cooperate semantically, however, wanting the thoughts we express to be clear, we may also want to use speech to deceive an audience about what we actually believe. Speaking is thus a two-level process. At the first level, expressing communicative intention, there is usually no possibility of meaningful defection, but the situation changes at the second level, expressing propositional states, when one can calculatingly advance personal goals by making misleading assertions. Whereas social norms of meaning are observed without fail, social norms of truth-telling may be violated by people who are pursuing their separate interests. Lying for personal advantage is the obvious illustration of such separateness. It shows that first-level understandings do not entail second-level trustworthiness, creating the problem that commitment to telling the truth and observing moral norms generally can be contrary to the strategic desire-belief model of rational action. As we have noted, Tomasello recognizes this conflict, but empirical models are not sufficient to address it. In discussing the origin of social norms of morality, he notes that early humans not only experienced individual instrumental pressure, but also experienced second-personal social pressure from their partners in social engagements. Psychologically, this pressure may not only include accepting moral norms and making one susceptible to the moral emotions they support, but doing so also leaves open the philosophical question of whether an individual's instrumental reasoning may override social norms when imperatives collide. By focusing upon specifically evaluated requirements harbored within the language of virtues and vices, which expresses our emotional responses to things, we will be able to describe a measure of reasonable collective intentionality, a tendency to norm conformity, without underplaying the role of personal desires that may collide with established moral rules. The philosophical model of rationality is not confined to practical considerations. On this model, rationality also enables people who have made valid inferences from the same true premises to agree in their conclusions. Thinking about virtues notably departs from this ideal of theoretical reason. As Hobbes complained, the language of virtue and vice gives everything a tincture of our different passions and renders applications of this language inconstant, preventing it from being true grounds of any ratiocination. Hobbes, 1651, 1991, 31. Since ratiocination for Hobbes is simply truth-preserving reckoning or inference, rational agreements about ethical ascriptions, claims of virtue and vice, are not to be expected for such emotionally tinged thinking. Thus, even when everyone agrees on all the descriptive features of a threat, they may differ about its fear-worthiness, hence about the wisdom of fleeing it. Impartial knowledge cannot be counted upon to resolve such differences, leaving wisdom and like emotionally laden, but inadequate markers for rational inference. If one person calls wisdom what another calls fear, they may not be disagreeing about the facts, but championing certain inclusions within the word's applications. Where you may consider appropriate to address fear by fleeing the threat, I may demur regarding the action you call wise as a sign of timidity or inability to see beyond the fittingness of the fear to the value of fighting to protect a good. Similarly, cruel and just may be used to characterize pains visited upon people who violate their agreements, but they also convey conflicting views about the worthiness of sympathizing with those pains. We then differ about whether causing pain is warranted hence just, or objectionable hence cruel. We therefore need to understand how it is possible to have meaningful arguments about these differences. It is widely recognized that the language of virtues and vices is typically thick, conveying elements of both description and evaluation. In contrast to just and cruel, good and bad provide little or no descriptive information. The language of virtues and vices is also emotionally laden. Just and wise convey admiration, cruel and timid convey contempt. These properties show that the ethical language would be unnecessary if we responded only dispassionately to pains, threats, and the other things we emotionally care about. But how are we to understand differences in the way different people apply thick terms? The classical emotivist answer sharply separates the meaning of these terms into a descriptive component, referring to an observer-independent quality, and a tincture of passion or preferential state that differs non-cognitively between individual persons. Thus, just refers to certain pains that one approves, whereas cruel connotes disapproval of them, leaving people who agree on the facts about pain without grounds for arguing significantly whether a painful action is cruel or just. However, there is another way of unraveling the meaning of thick ethical terms largely original to this essay, namely by identifying both the descriptive reasons for their use and the reasons for the associated judgments of emotion worthiness. Their explication then includes both pains and the view that these pains are, in the case of justice, worthy of approval or, in the case of cruelty, worthy of disapproval. Understanding the words thereby presupposes the reasons that support the evaluation in question, even if the giving of those reasons does not involve the kind of truth-preserving reasoning that is typical of the mathematical and empirical sciences. Judgment of emotional fittingness can be seen as concerning the descriptive dimension of ethical argument, whereas judgment of emotional worthiness concerns the evaluative dimension. All too often, the difference between these forms of judgment is neglected or overlooked. In discussing the fundamentality of fit, for example, Christopher Howard, 2018-2019, says, "The normative relation of fittingness is a relation in which a response stands to an object when the object merits or is worthy of that response. This conflation should be avoided since, as we have noted, fearful responses can be recognized as fitting even if deemed unworthy, and a similar point can be made for emotions generally. It is sometimes said that anger or envy are unfitting responses to another's inconsiderateness or good fortune, but the intended judgments call upon the conceptual resources of emotional worthiness. Of course, one might reject the distinction between fittingness and worthiness by speaking of worthiness of approval as just another way of expressing approval. This would be to deny the possibility of significant reasoning about passionate responses, leaving judgments to be influenced by rhetorical persuasion rather than solid evidence. There would then be no philosophically good reason for expecting ethical agreement. The alternative is to develop the point that reasoning is not restricted to rationality. We should be able to agree that I have a reason to cause others pain if I am fittingly angered by their having caused me an injury, but we need not agree that it is a rationally sufficient reason. You may reasonably maintain that my anger is unworthy of the offense, because the offense was, perhaps, not serious enough. Our respective reasoning is fully consistent with the complaint that there are no adequate natural criteria for evaluative norms, so that even people in command of all the describable facts may differ in their ethical judgments. Our thinking about virtues, therefore, does not satisfy a principal condition of rational judgment. That is, it does not express rational judgments in the sense of rational that seeks the agreement of fully knowledgeable people. All of this is compatible with recognizing that beliefs about emotional worthiness may be backed by strong reasons. Reasons for ethical ascriptions are most clearly available as long as one can appeal to what is considered normal by the prevailing collective standards that constitute common sense. However, this opening to reasons leaves an obvious problem for any moral rationalism that supposes that contests about emotional worthiness can be definitively settled. As we have noticed with respect to the objectivity of Tomasello's social norms, references to the property require scare quotes. After all, common sense is inherently changeable. Its standards are open to question and challenge. Our command of ethical language includes a semantic knowledge that causing excessive pain is cruel, hence undesirable. But in the absence of natural measures of excess, one has only other accepted examples of the ethical property to call upon in identifying new cases. An action is cruel in comparison to some established paradigm of cruelty. In the case of virtues as well, One cannot do better than provide comparisons that most people accept as exemplars of kindness, justice, and other desirable qualities of action and character. Because such comparisons are open to question, the philosophical challenge is to understand how they can provide good reasons in practical deliberation and yet do not compel agreement. Reasonable norm conformity, linguistic and ethical. The thesis that good evaluative reasons do not have to be rationally demonstrable can be summarized in this way. Ethical differences may be epistemically faultless. That is, people's competing opinions about ethical matters need not result only from errors and omissions, although these are a frequent source of moral conflict, but can also arise from conflicting emotional responses. I may sympathize with a person's distress, and you may agree that my response is fitting, but deny that it is the most worthy one. In place of normative objectivity in such matters, there are patterns of reaction that may differ from individual to individual. Supposing this to be the case for ascriptions of virtue and vice generally, 14 disputes about them need not constitute strict disagreements. 15, in other words, they do not entail errors by one party or another, and in this respect are not subject to rational adjudication. However, this is a narrow technical point. It does not imply that our different emotions, her sympathy for my pain, his approval of that pain, preclude constructive examination. Rather, the point is important for encouraging the realization that when ethical differences arise or moral common sense is confounded, we need reasonable discussion. In order to make this case, I will develop elements of difference between descriptive, institutional, and ethical language. In contrast to thick ethical language, our use of simple descriptive terms rarely produces extended debate. Even if we understand these terms as labels for inner experiences, an open question, they easily become referentially trustworthy. Participation in a linguistic community enables me to suppose that your use of the word gold, colored, or square has pretty much the same extension as mine unless too many persistent conflicts occur between our statements. In this case, one of us might be suspected of speaking in some kind of code or changing the subject. So long as such conflicts and suspicions do not emerge, mutual confidence in one another's speech is warranted because the references of our words is underwritten by linguistic agreements that are true to the world. A similar story can be told about words for secondary qualities. In using color words, dependably we accept public, linguistic norms despite the possibility that they mark subjective sensory kinds that have no public expression. Even if we cannot convey the subjective content of our perceptions of color to others, another open question, the word red refers to the visible similarity of objects that English speakers agree are red. The crucial issue with respect to cruelty is whether the pain in question is excessive or undue, hence worthy of moral disdain. This is not a simple quantitative matter, but an evaluative one that deprives assertions of cruelty of a robust naturalistic test of truth and thus denies the question a technically rational answer. The model of institutional facts is meant to resolve this problem and at first looks promising. A widow is a female survivor. And while the concept of survivors has no inherently normative implications, the legal standing of widows includes answerable questions about their rights and responsibilities. Similarly, one might argue that legally setting a punishment is meant to imply that it is not excessively painful, while leaving it open for the law to embed explicit standards beyond which punishment is deemed cruel. The authority of the state thereby stabilizes the extensions of just and cruel and secures unequivocal practical conclusions. Institutionalizing ethical ascriptions in this way no doubt captures some complex legal and social truths, but the difficulty for proposal is clear from the need for three interrelated qualifications. One is that in order to be effective, the law must normally be sanctioned by custom. Legislation alone does not produce a sense of the law's validity, which requires a public understanding that leads to an effective and intellectual respect for political authority. This task can be as formidable as is essential, since in order for the political specification of cruelty and the like to not appear arbitrary, the state has to defer to the informed judgments of that ubiquitous character in legal judgment, the reasonable person. This is an important but uncertain standard because reasonable people may differ, in which case the legal fiction cannot be employed where common sense is most needed to end an argument. A second qualification recognizes that the shapelessness of ethical terms frustrates the capacity of laws to provide a constant meaning to them. The popular references of words like cruel are not normally unified under a descriptive concept that comprises the non-ethical features associated with the term. Kirchen 2010-5. Even paradigm cases of cruelty for which there is no gap between popular applications of the word and its political specification are potentially subject to drifting responses, leaving it impossible to dependably identify the descriptive content of cruelty. The concept has to be more descriptively complex than painful, since it is easy to identify pains that are not widely regarded as cruel, but normative issues arise in seeking a more adequate representation. As suggested above, we may say that painful things are cruel unless there are factors warranting the pain, such as crimes whose punishment is kept within a certain level of severity, but no such property will unequivocally limit the descriptive sense of cruel to definite applications recognized by all. If, for example, unusually severe pain regularly resulted in useful learning or reformed behavior, this corrective influence would convince some that its infliction was appropriate after all. Any descriptive specification of undue pain can prove ethically defeasible, suggesting the permanent possibility of tensions between the laws and their popular acceptance. A final qualification follows from the fact that efforts to explicate words for virtues and vices in terms of legal facts omit the evaluative dimension identified earlier. The belief that something is cruel consists in more than a reference to a pain of some kind with legal sanction or disapproval, because that belief includes a view of the pain as excessive or unwarranted. Cruel does convey disapproval in assertive context, but it is reasoned disapproval rather than simple affective aversion. It can be backed up by examples, analogies, comparisons, and other reasons that justify sympathy for the sufferer and indignation in the observer. A punishment may thus be legally mandated, but seem unworthy of the crime. The words for virtues and vices in general have this compound structure, conveying worthiness or unworthiness, as well as painfulness or other fitting properties. Because our ascriptions of worthiness may differ, we encounter inconstancy of reference with respect to cruel. But the evaluative claim gives our ethical language an element of the constancy that is typical of semantic cooperation. That is, we agree semantically that something is cruel when it causes excessive or undue pain, even if our different emotion responses prevent agreement about when in fact this is the case. Ninth, cruel means unduly painful, notwithstanding individual variation in ascriptions of such pains. Although ethical language has inconstant references, its terms of constant evaluative valences, making a contradiction say, that is cruel but not unduly painful. 20. Now, it is possible to contest the semantic point by stressing comparison of words for vices with other thick terms. For example, many ethical terms and pejoratives are alike in being objectionable to some people, just as many people find ethnic slurs unacceptable and egoists might object to the ethically negative uses of selfish for suggesting that an expression of self-interest can be undue. The objection, like the coherence of Ayn Rand's defiant title, the virtue of selfishness implies that the word does not include an unfavorable evaluation within its meaning. However, it is not correct that a philosophical position such as egoism can cancel the entailment of undue by selfish in this way. By proposing that selfish says nothing beyond self-interest of the egoist is engaged in linguistic revisionism, stipulating a narrow, non-evaluative meaning for the word, and thereby begging the question against the word's invariantly negative valence. Egoists are, in effect, removing themselves from a conversation. However, the cost of denying a stake in ethical judgments about permissible levels of self-interest and inflictions of pain is high. It amounts to insensitivity to the class of ethical terms that express the principles evident in their normative dimension. Thus, cruelty offends a principle of justice that calls for giving persons what they're due, and selfishness conflicts with avoiding excessive self-interest. Similarly, courage is pride-worthy willingness to face evil for the sake of greater good. These principles are conceptual truths. Recognizing them as marks of emotion worthiness is fully consistent with making conflicting assessments of the extensions of ethical terms, and that recognition is sufficient for understanding that they are semantic parts of the words for the virtues in question. Even if we diverge on the identification of the greater good, we understand the ethical implication of the concept of courage. To recapitulate, we have the following three necessary qualifications to political or institutional specifications of ethical words. 1. Effective legislation requires the endorsement of custom, which is inherently challengeable and changeable. 2. The shapelessness of ethical words resists definitive statements of what describable properties count as virtues or vices. And 3, efforts to explicate words for virtues and vices in terms of institutional facts omit the evaluated dimension of their meaning, taken altogether. These points imply that although human beings are normally in semantic agreement, we cannot be forced to ethical agreement by conventions that make a cluster of descriptive features count as a social fact. They thereby mirror Tomasello's qualifications to his cultural objectivism and indicate that when reasonable persons diverge in their use of ethical terms, we should be cautious about what we mean when saying two thinkers who grasp the same sense can disagree about its correct extension, Varinin 2013, 189-189. The reason for caution about Varinin's statement is that if there is no philosophically correct position, then assigning different extensions to cruel or just does not amount to rational disagreement. This is the crucial point about epistemic faultlessness. When you and I dispute the cruelty and justice of a certain punishment, we can often acknowledge that our opinions express our different assessments of the circumstances and recognize that our judgments are both informed. We can continue to argue and may succeed in moderating our differences by appreciating one another's perspectives. However, that shows that we are getting our emotional responses into more thoughtful alignment with one another, not that we are closer to getting things right. The constant evaluative valence of ethical words leaves differences about their signification or reference a continuing possibility. This constant valence is part of the structure of linguistic community and public discourse. People have historically sought to determine what justice requires in the political recognition of men and women. For example, the answers given have changed, but this is not surprising because our emotional responses have become answerable to new sets of common sense comparisons. If citizens have political rights, then are women not sufficiently like citizens to have the same rights? Such issues are advanced by defensible analogies with previously settled cases that promote emotional realignment. However, everything is like everything else in some respect, leaving one person's comparisons logically open to another's charge of superficiality. More and more people have begun to compare solitary confinement with already outlawed forms of torture, but we continue to differ about whether all capital punishment is cruel. It is because there is no obviously factual way of settling such differences that ethical reasons do not satisfy the norms of theoretical reason that require factual determination and logical validity. Emotional alignment and misalignment do nonetheless occur within the space of reasons, enabling reasonable normative deliberation to occur. Such deliberation links semantic competence with a philosophically justifiable motivation to seek ethical norm conformity, in a way I will now try to establish. The deliberative weight of ethical norms. The issue is when the existence of a social norm provides a personal reason for following it. Of course, the Leviathan of orthodox society can conventionally discourage norm-offending behavior, but could prevent norm-challenging opinion only by effectively determining the extensions of the words that express ethical judgments. In this case, we would agree on which painful actions are just and which are cruel. It is one thing, however, to accept the social rules governing the meanings of the words of our ethical language as we do. It is another thing to accept the code of ethics determined by a standard set of established reference for cruel, just, and the like. There is a vital relationship between these linguistic and ethical norms, but it needs clarification in order to show how the use of words for virtues and vices includes opportunities for communal deliberation that stands in cognitive contrast to unreasonably colliding individuals. The account should wrap together the relationship between semantic and ethical norms in a way that shows what it is to be bound by an ethical norm and why such norms can overrule one's personal objectives even when opportunities to obtain them beckon. One view of the relationship between linguistic and ethical norms is that a linguistic community enables us to recognize that the meaning of cruel includes excessively painful, but restricts tests of excessiveness to norms that hardly anyone contests. Tomasello's Natural Histories reflect this view, stressing the institutionalization of ethical language. They say that people are psychologically bound by the established norms of their culture, so that conventional society governs ethical thinking as well as ethical behavior. However, this picture of collective intentionality has little to say about how we can have good reasons to be rule-bound in the first place. Some recent philosophical treatments attempt to address this limitation. Joseph Heath offers an account of linguistic and ethical norms as parts of a single rational system. In criticizing the instrumentalist individualism that explains social practices in terms of self-interested agency, he argues that the motivational structures associated with norm conformity are not merely conventional, but transcendentally necessary. Heath, 2011, 216. We cannot coherently choose to abandon our psychological tendency to norm conformity. A rational agent cannot subscribe to wholesale rejection of inconvenient social rules because that would violate the linguistic conditions of the possibility of thought. Hence, we are motivated to accept ethical constraints. Without this disposition, we could not participate in the practice of giving reasons at all. Heath does not mean that a person must actually endorse the prevailing set of social norms in order to use language. Heath, 2011, 221. He recognizes that people can rationally engage in acts of social deviance and is therefore only assigning normative reasons for action considerable deliberative weight. Heath, 2011, 221. He does not explicate the concept of deliberative weight, but however it should be construed, I will return to this crucial matter. There is an obvious objection to his argument. In order to understand reasons giving, we need not respect all social norms, but only the network of linguistic rules that enmesh rational agents. To this objection, he replies that language is woven into the fabric of all social actions, so that agents cannot adopt a disposition to respect only linguistic or cognitive norms. Heath, 2003, 378 to 397, 393. Hence, by the time one has learned a language, it is already too late to abandon the moral disposition as well. However, this response neglects the difference between first and second level norms of cooperation distinguished in the F. Erse section above. Even on the assumption that all deliberate social actions presuppose a developed capacity for language, that capacity includes reference back to our own interests, our desire to be understood, rather than following moral rules for their own sake. Individual intentionality seems intact beyond first-level linguistic community because we can distinguish between semantic rules of communicative intention and ethical rules calling for sincere and truthful expression of one's thoughts. As a result, appeal to transcendental necessity does not well explain the weight accorded to ethical rules. Paul Faulkner also supports the rationality of a general disposition towards norm conformity, but he makes a bootstrapping rather than transcendental case for it. He suggests that choosing to trust others to comply with social norms itself creates reasons that justify this emotion. The act of trust is rationally self-supporting in that it is based on attitude of trust, which through implying presumption that the trusted is trustworthy, gives a reason for trusting. Faulkner, 2011, 151. 21 thus, friends naturally ascribe to one another reasons to act in the knowledge that they depend upon each other to be trustworthy. Trust exercises ethical constraint from the beginning, since the emotional bond overrules the personal interests of purely instrumental agents. However, it is not clear how the amicable connection extends to others whom one has not learned to trust. The argument does not clearly link this bond to generally binding norms, leaving problems for second-level trust in others when there are neither predictive nor effective grounds for trusting them to mean what they say they mean or intend. The rationalistic concern that self-interested persons may lack sufficient reason for honesty remains, along with the same concern for exercising other virtues. Stephen Darwall offers one further defense of norm conformity, stressing an idea much like Tomasello's we intentionality. Interpersonal relationships of this kind are present in emotions of gratitude, resentment, respect, esteem, and similarly reactive attitudes. The persons who are the objects of such emotions exist in an ethical relationship with one another rather than constituting objects to be manipulated for one's own purely instrumental, self-interested purposes. Darwall addresses the limitations of friendly trust that we found in Faulkner by noting that some justifiable human attitudes extend ethical relationships to everyone. In contrast to honor, which belongs to an essentially hierarchical social order, Darwall, 2013-17, respect for persons is not bestowed for certain culturally approved merits, but in recognition of the equal dignity of all moral agents without regard to personal merit. It is not clear why this egalitarian conviction should not itself be regarded as a cultural preference. Without a demonstration of the universality of human dignity, we have no decisive grounds for favoring one ethos over another. We therefore seem philosophically limited to a view of moral relationships that is open to both hierarchical and egalitarian interpretations, leaving the obligation to be honest towards everyone an open question. Although transcendental bootstrapping and second-personal arguments for ethical nonconformity all prove difficult to state convincingly, we have already established grounds for a better case that established moral rules should be respected, if not necessarily accepted. Although first-level linguistic trustworthiness does not by itself justify trusting others to tell the truth or abide by other moral norms, it does include sensitivity to moral reasons and satisfies Heath's demand for normative claims to have deliberative weight. This weight arises from our wish to be understood when using normative language, and hence from a mutual recognition of the evaluated dimension of the words we use. We all know that in regarding a statement as not only false but also dishonest, or an action as not only painful but also cruel, we take the statement or action to be worthy of disapproval. Of course, the merits of disapproval may come into dispute because conforming to semantic rules leaves ethical standards open to reason challenge. Nevertheless, mastering these semantic rules enables us to understand that in judging an assertion to be dishonest or a punishment to be cruel, we are expressing a conception of honesty or cruelty that is open for discussion. We can compare the degree and circumstances of the falsehood or pain in question with those typical or generally acknowledged cases of dishonesty or cruelty, suggesting relevant similarities and differences that may evoke a sensitive response. In short, a consequence of being norm-conforming with ethical language is that we are norm-seeking with respect to its applications to particular cases. Wanting to use ethical language correctly, we advance our conceptions of ethical worthiness and open them to comparison with those of others. Our semantic competence thus includes an at least rudimentary appreciation of moral reasons for judgment and action. This conclusion confirms and explicates the deliberative weight of established ethical norms by showing how established moral rules warrant consideration without rationally requiring that one subscribe to those rules. It thereby shows the possibility of questioning the canons of moral convention and the verities of common sense in ways that challenge rationalistic aspirations to universal agreement. Reasonable ethical debates thus recognize the descriptive openness of ethical language and the alternative viewpoints it permits. Normative inquiry resists complete factual determination and can therefore prove frustrating, but also concerns matters that are open to continuing social discussion. The original meaning of ethical words, including their constant evaluative valence, keeps them subject to communal deliberation rather than expressing mere preferences or individual passions that are not answerable to any argument. Moral claims are thus not simply subjective. Because linguistic norm conformity generates ethical norm seeking, it demands ethical reasons that tend to discourage defecting from practical agreements. It is no guarantee against affection, but provides a reasonable basis for trust in others' good behavior. Insofar as first-level linguistic trust already includes an ethical relationship in this way, one's desires are moderated by a disposition to tell the truth to one's interlocutors. For example, this disposition may easily be overridden by utilitarian calculation, but most individuals are not simple opportunists. They are clearly motivated in part by the kind of moral regard for others evident in trust, sympathy, respect, resentment, etc. As a result, they are capable of the collective intentionality sought amongst those who are engaged in a common project. Our capacity for trustworthy relationships is widely recognized, but it is philosophically dubious to model it upon instrumental rationalism rather than the motivations provided by moral emotions. It is equally dubious to expect it to result in moral consensus. This further result might seem to frustrate the common project by logically dissociating command of ethical language from moral common sense, but the inherent contestability of virtuous scriptions does not entail unruly ethical differences. As in the case of words for institutional kinds, the references of words for virtues and vices are capable of pretty general consent. There are norms of cruelty, justice, and the like established within a community, that is, wherever a measure of common sense prevails. Disputes do occur when particular norms come to be challenged, as when novel circumstances raise questions whose answers are not clear prevailing standards of reasonableness. Think of issues in medical ethics emerging from the use of new technologies of gene splicing. In these circumstances, public debate may reshape individual intuitions in a resilient way that encourages political authority to sanction, accelerate, and help solidify those reshaped intuitions in newly legalized practices. Think of mixed race, then same-sex marriages. For the most part, individual persons and their societies change together, making the common project easier than what narrowly rationalistic explanations of human practices might suggest. To draw these points together, philosophical worries about the inconstant and equivocal nature of ethical language, the inconstant applications of words for virtues and vices, are well addressed the relationship between linguistic norms and the reasonableness of moral emotions. This relationship supports the expectation that other persons are not unthinkingly rule-bound, but are considered opinions of vice and virtue, hence reasoned judgments of emotion-worthiness. Commonly using a word like cruel, just, honest, or deceitful includes recognizing that its evaluative reach includes the associated moral emotions. The features of the world that actually justify these responses are open to debate, but the linguistic agreement can moderate conflicts of judgment by making the passions answerable to mutual deliberation. Admittedly, this aspiration is easily thwarted, so that hopes of sustaining a general sense of virtue are never likely to be fully realized. Nevertheless, there remains a definable project of developing and sustaining a body of common sense concerning particulars of acting well. The accord will always be open to question, but this is actually a good thing, since we should want deliberation to modify agreement if circumstances warrant that. As long as these matters remain under sincere discussion, they can be part of a viable community even without an ideal observer, infallible pope, or moral or political sovereign capable of determining the references of ethical concepts. To be sure, societies lacking stable ethical relationships may be ungovernable without political power that is not accountable to the people. However, intractable social divisions are contingencies that occur only in certain local circumstances. The important philosophical point is that the existence of some final authority is not a requirement of practical reason. Some psychological contingencies bear upon the view of moral reason's advance here, and the thesis that mastering ethical language includes capacities for moral emotions. People on the autism spectrum are norm-bound agents insofar as they can communicate with others by speaking the same language. At the same time, autism includes a preference for descriptive literalness and a tendency to avoid creative uses of language, such as comparison and analogy, Baron-Cohen 1995-2009. The condition also includes lack of imaginative entry into other minds, puzzlement about responding to others' emotions, and low affective empathy, Baron-Cohen 1995-2009. These problems in understanding the social emotions suggest that first-level linguistic trustworthiness does not always include a full range of reasoned ethical relationships. Although autistic persons may be able to talk about natural and institutional kinds, they can be expected to do less well with the language of virtues and vices. 22. This limitation hardly shows that inconstant names are not, for most people, useful instrument of ethical reasoning. Rather, speaking of a limitation is a way of recognizing that most human beings possess an emotional range that includes a tendency to accept ethical norms. If not narrowly rational, that tendency is nevertheless guided by a quest for good reasons. These philosophical points are consistent with scientific observations that the primates most like us are self-interested rather than moral agents. Great apes lack the kind of collective intentionality that emerges only with the development of complex ethical connections coeval with the reasonableness that includes non-instrumental reasons to speak the truth, abide by one's undertakings, and a core measure of authority to common sense morality. Such reasons are part of the moral competence that most human beings, even mutual strangers, enjoy as part of their ability to master ethical language. Commanding this vocabulary allows for engagement in constructive ethical deliberation through recognizing the fittingness of moral emotions and engaging in reasoned debate about their worthiness.